Today's program is brought to you by Cowgirl Creamery, a company located in Point Reyes Station, California, which manufactures artisanal cheeses. For more information, visit cowgirlcreamery.com.
Episode 163 of The Morning After. I am your host today, Sari Kamen. My co-host, the lovely Jessie Kiefer, is not here. She is instead in New Orleans, drinking all sorts of fruity, grenade-y type things, I'm sure. I am very sad that she's not here, but I'm also very happy because I have the amazing Kenji Lopez Alt on the air with me today. Kenji, you there?
Yeah, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm really good.
You're in San Francisco, right?
Actually, San Mateo. It's a little bit south of San Francisco.
Okay.
We're close.
Well, I'm so glad you could join us, and I'm really excited to talk to you today. Before we do that, I have some food news that I'd like to share, if you would indulge me, Kenji.
Sure, no problem.
Okay, because on the show, what we do at the top is we have to share the most important headlines of the week, and I'm talking way more important than the presidential election, you know. these are showstoppers. So the first thing that we need to tell you guys about is that a horse penis sausage joke got a man deported from Kyrgyzstan this week. Now, apparently, in Kyrgyzstan, I see you already have thoughts. Kyrgyzstan, a horse penis sausage is actually like a major delicacy there. Like, it might actually be their national food. And apparently, there's like a big mining community. And this Scottish guy, this miner, was in Kyrgyzstan like to do some mining project, and he was eating sausage, not horse penis sausage, in fact, just like regular old sausage, and he got so excited that his sausage looked like a penis that he made like a hilarious joke on Facebook, nonetheless, about how like everyone in Kyrgyzstan is like lining up to eat horse penis, and all of his like mining buddies got super offended. There was like a huge strike at the mine, like this thing just like escalated, and the authorities were contacted, and like one thing led to another, and this guy tried to flee the country and was arrested at the airport.
Wait, so which part of it do you think was the offensive part? Do you think it was the eating penis part, or the eating horse part, or maybe the lining up?
No,
part? Were there the combination of all three?
Well, the offensive part is that he made fun of like their national dish. So the Kyrgyzstanians were like took offense to the fact that he like insulted their culinary tradition and like their nationalistic pride. No, it's true.
It's like going to Chicago and telling them that their pizza is casserole.
Exactly. It's exactly like that, but you probably won't get arrested in Chicago for doing that, even if you put it on Facebook.
Just beaten up,
and like, which is totally fair. But this guy got arrested at the airport. He got like dragged back. And he faced like several years in prison, but he went on Facebook, he apologized, he was like, I'm so sorry that I insulted like your heritage and like your best dish, like your number one, like most favorite dish of your country, like my bad, horse penises are great. And they were like, all right, we're not going to arrest you, we're just going to deport you. And he got kicked out of the country. Isn't that crazy?
Crazy. Maybe it sounds like maybe a simplification of events, but I have no idea. Maybe that's exactly.
I might have possibly simplified it for the sake of the show. Yes, that is possibly true. But still super weird. And like, I don't understand why he made a horse penis joke not eating a horse penis. Like if you're going to eat a horse penis, I feel like it's fair game to joke about it. Otherwise.
I mean, you know, having worked in restaurants where, I mean, you know, anytime there's a penis shaped food, you make jokes about it.
Well, I think that's what was going on. But it seems weird. It's like, ha ha ha, horse penis. Like, but they eat horse penis. Like, it doesn't. The joke doesn't fly. All right, moving on. I know that one is tricky. All right, so moving on. This woman was cooking up some dinner. I believe it was in Kansas. And she was making this, like, green bean casserole for her church. So she was, like, making a ton of it. She had all these cans of green beans. She was taking some green beans out of the can. And she noticed something that, like, sort of looked like a burnt green bean. But then she noticed it was the head of a snake. So
The head of a snake.
The head of a snake, but not the body. So two things here. Super disturbing for there to be a head of a snake in your green beans, masquerading as a green bean. Possibly more super
also,
disturbing.
Where the rest of the snake went.
That's the other super disturbing part. Like,
was it maybe like a green snake that had just about the same circumference, like a small snake that had about the same circumference as a green bean?
No. No, apparently.
Okay, could the snake body have been camouflaged in there with the rest of the green beans?
The snake body is MIA. Someone else is going to open up a can of green beans. So we're like, you know, awaiting to find out what happens here. So she took it back to the store. They're apparently called Western Family Green Beans. So those have been taken out.
Okay.
They got those off the store. They're in search. They're like looking through to try and find the missing snake body. And
so are we sure the snake fell into the, like, got into the green beans, or maybe it just spontaneously generated in the can after the can was sealed?
It might have spontaneously generated. Like, it could actually be anywhere.
I think the first snakes actually came from cans of green beans.
Oh, is that how they started?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that how baby Jesus made little snakes?
No, it's St. Patrick, right? I don't know.
Right. I definitely think there's a stork involved somewhere.
Yeah, I don't know.
You're supposed to know everything about food.
Right.
Oh, I finally stumped you. Okay, the last one, this is a story that's been kind of like going in and out of the news for a while, and I think that you'll have some comments on this. So apparently the story is back that there's wood in our grated Parmesan cheese, and like this is resurfaced again. Have you heard about this, Kenji?
That there's wood?
There's wood pulp found in grated Parmesan cheese in the United States. Like, they've been doing...
Okay. Like lots of it, or...
Like, kind of a lot of... Like way more than they're supposed to be, because they're supposed to be nice.
Like, if Parmesan cheese were a can of beans, there's, like, a snakehead-sized amount of...
There's definitely a snakehead-sized amount. There's no official, you know, statistics to what I'm saying right now, but yes, there's definitely a snakehead-sized amount of wood pulp. That's showing up in grated cheese, kind of being used as a filler. Like, I read one article that says it's cellulose. Like, cellulose is wood pulp, or cellulose contains wood pulp.
Well, I mean, that makes sense, right? Like, all grated cheeses have cellulose in them, to keep them from clumping.
Right.
Maybe they accidentally put too much in at some point.
I think
Although,
that's
to be honest,
it.
Like, it's pretty hard to tell the difference between pre-grated Parmesan cheese and sawdust to begin with. So I'm not sure what people are complaining about.
Oh, was that like a diss on grated Parmesan cheese? Was that like a Parmesan cheese burn that just occurred here? Well, one article said it is cellulose and that contains wood pulp, but another article said there's wood pulp in addition to cellulose. So I'm not sure. Like, it still feels kind of fuzzy, but I mean, the grated Parmesan cheese ingredients should be nothing but cheese or milk, rennet, and water, and then there's like the big problem is the transparency issue.
It's probably more of a labeling issue than like a safety or
right.
To me, it sounds sort of like fear mongering. It's like, you know, like people who say, "Oh, this ingredient in this can of spaghetti is also used to make windshield wiper detergent or something like that." You know, it's like, well, you know, first of all, you know, the dose determines the poison. And second of all, just because something is used in one industry doesn't mean that it can't be safely used in another. You know, it takes water to make silicone chips for computers. That doesn't mean that we can't put water into our food. You know, it feels to me sort of like fear mongering. At worst, it's probably just either, you know, an error that they put maybe too much cellulose in which case maybe you taste it or feel it. But cellulose is, you know, it's edible. It's not going to kill you.
Even if you eat
the real problem, I think, is maybe the labeling.
It.
You know, because when you do buy grated cheese that has powdered cellulose on it to keep from clumping, it will say that it has either cellulose or some kind of starch added to there. So if the packages are saying 100% Parmesan cheese,
that's it.
Cellulose there, then that's the issue probably. I don't. The rest of it seems to me like pure mongering.
Yeah, I mean, there's always a lot of gray areas in terms of like how much of something you can use, or like if the FDA deems it safe, but like no one really knows for sure. I don't know. Anyway, I guess that's not very shocking. Like, don't buy grated Parmesan cheese in bags, I guess, like, from Kraft and expect it to be, like, from, you know, Parma. Like, not a huge surprise. But anyway, thank you for addressing our safety concerns. And we're going to take a break. We're going to hear a commercial, and then we're going to come back and talk more with you, Kenji Lopez-Alt.
All right.
All right. Stay tuned.
Sounds good.
In 1997, Sue Conley and Peggy Smith opened Cowgirl Creamery in a tiny coastal town an hour north of San Francisco. They started with an old barn, made it beautiful, put in a small plant for making handcrafted cheese, bought organic milk from the neighbor, Strauss Family Creamery, and before long the world found them. Today, Cowgirl Creamery cheeses are sold across the country at independent cheese shops, restaurants, and specialty grocers across the country. For more information, visit cowgirlcreamery.com.
And we're back. You're listening to The Morning After on heritageradionetwork.org. I am your host, Sari Kamen. I am sitting in the back of Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, and I am definitely creeping on some pizza action that's happening in front of me. It's the weirdest.
Oh, man, I miss it. I miss good pizza. I mean, no insult to San Francisco, which has some great food, but getting a good slice of pizza, I know Roberta's a few places, but just being able to walk down the street and get a good slice of pizza, that's like the thing I miss most about New York.
Well, why don't you just come back?
Weather's too nice out here. I don't know. People are nice.
Well, let me give you your proper introduction, because we haven't done that yet. The folks at home, you know, they know what's up. This is J. Kenji Lopez-Alt. He is the managing culinary director of Serious Eats. He is the author of the James Beard-nominated column, The Food Lab, which is on Serious Eats. And he's also the author of the New York Times bestselling book, The Food Lab. Welcome to the show, Kenji.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And is it J. Kenji or Kenji? What's your preference?
I said just Kenji.
Okay, I feel comfortable with Kenji.
Yeah.
I'll try not to slip to, like, Ken or G.
The J there I put in mainly so that when people put me on email lists, like marketing email lists and stuff, I can immediately tell if they really know me or not. Because
right.
If they don't know me, will call me J. Kenji. And I'm like, all right, that's like automatic filter.
Yeah, totally. Okay, well, everyone who's listening, you know, don't spread the secret too far.
Now they know the secret, yeah.
Yeah, they do. So you have a new book. It's a New York Times best-selling book, which is amazing. Congratulations. It's called The Food Lab.
Thank you.
I mean, it's quite a labor of love. It's just massive. And it's written for home cooks, but it's for them to understand how to use, like, how to apply science more in their cooking. So I thought it would be cool, like, if you could just tell us a little bit about your background, because I know you've worked in restaurants and you have a culinary background, but you also have this super scientific approach to the culinary arts. So just sort of tell us, like, give us the brief story of, like, how you were able to kind of, like, merge these, I don't know, maybe even two sides of your brain.
The brief story. All right. Well, so, you know, I was supposed to be a scientist when I was a kid, you know, like, it's what I wanted to do. My dad was a scientist. My grandpa was a scientist. And it was the main part of my education growing up. So all my classes were based, all of my extra classes were in science, and I would go to it. I would take science classes on Saturdays, and you know, it was just a big part of my education, and I really loved it. And so I ended up going to an engineering school, I was going to be a biology major. And then I realized, you know, after a couple of years of doing it, that as much as I loved the science element and the learning aspects, that the day-to-day lab work was just not something that I could see myself doing. I guess I was just a little bit impatient in that regard. So I started to look for other fields where I could still, use science and engineering, based fields. And at the same time, you know, I decided to take a summer off, basically just a summer of non-academic work. This was the summer after my sophomore year in college. And I accidentally sort of fell into a job at a restaurant, basically just walked in looking for a job as a waiter. And they told me right there that they had a prep cook who didn't show up that morning, so if I could work that afternoon, that I could have a job for the summer. So that seemed kind of fun. Like, I'd never considered it before.
Did they not care that you'd never worked in a kitchen before?
They honestly didn't. You know,
they were desperate.
It wasn't a fantastic restaurant.
Well,
they basically just needed a body in there who could, you know, hold a knife and do what people told them. And, you know, I was willing to do what people told me, which is, you know, sort of what you have to do. And if you're coming into a restaurant, into the world of restaurants, that's what you do for the you know, first several years. You basically just do what people tell you. And you do it fast, and you do it efficiently, and you do it without complaining, and you put your head down and work, and that's sort of how you get ahead in restaurants. I had never cooked before in my life, really. I wasn't really into food, but I loved working in restaurants. Like, the minute I stepped into the kitchen, I just loved it. The whole sort of the pace of it, the adrenaline, like the sort of working together as a team, it all just felt right to me. And so I continued working in restaurants part-time all through the rest of school. And then when I graduated, I went into restaurants full-time. And, I never went to culinary school, so I did it sort of the traditional way. Like, I read a lot, I practiced my knife skills a lot in my free time, of which there was very little. And then, and I started working at really bad restaurants and sort of worked my way up to nicer ones. But like I said, at restaurants, like, your job is basically just to do what you're told. And there's a reason for that. And the reason is that they have to operate really, really efficiently. And if you take the time to start questioning things or maybe experimenting with things, then you're not going to be ready for service. And your guests are, the number one priority is getting the food on the plate at the time it's supposed to be on the plate and out the kitchen door to the customer's table. And anything else is just distracting from that. So for someone, for someone who had a big interest in science and who was raised, taught to think critically about things and be very skeptical of things and always ask why we're doing this and why we're doing that, it was a little tough for me because, there simply wasn't the time to ask this question. So the entire time I was working in restaurants, I loved it and I learned a ton. But at the same time, there was sort of this, like, backlog of questions that I was building up. And it's like, why are we doing this way? Why do we double fry potatoes when we make French fries? Like, why are we cooking the pasta in this much water? Like, all these questions that the answer, if you ask a chef, is basically, if I ask my chef, then it's basically, we don't have time to figure that out. Just do it the way it works, and that's that. I don't mean that to be a discredit to them. That is their job. But like I said, I had these questions building up. So eventually, I decided to try and see if I could find a job where I could combine the two. And that's how I happened upon a test cook position at Cooks Illustrated, which basically specializes in that kind of stuff, like answering common cooking questions through experimentation and developing recipes through experimentation. So that was kind of the ideal fit for me, and that's really where I started my writing career. I never really wrote much before that, so that's where I started my recipe editing and my writing career, From there, it just built up. I eventually left the company after a few years when I moved back home to New York, and it was in New York that I got a job at Sirius East, managing the recipe development and culinary program on the website, and that's where I've been since then. And the food lab all basically started there at Sirius East. And it has, grown over the last 5 or 6 years, way faster than I expected it to, and way bigger than I expected it to. But it really is sort of a dream job. I'm making a living doing basically what I would be doing in my spare time if I had another job. So I think it's just super lucky and really a dream come true for me.
It is, but it also really shows that there's, like, a whole community of people out there who want to
solve these problems. When the food lab started, it was basically, I was having a burger with Ed Levine, the founder of Sirius East, and he was, and this was before I was hired. I was still occasionally writing, like, freelance burger reviews and stuff for them. I think at the time they paid, like, $25 a piece or maybe $40 a piece, so something very, very minimal, but I enjoyed doing it, and I was having a burger with Ed, and he's like, you should... you're a good writer. You should have your own column. What do you want to write about? It's like, I've always wanted to write about food science. It's like, all right, like, you should write a food science column, and we'll call it the Food Lab. And I was like, okay. And so, like, a week later, I published the first one, and it was about hard-boiled eggs. And I was just doing it because it was something that I thought would be fun and was, like, really interested in me. And it was full of, like, stupid puns and bad jokes and, like, cheesy humor and tons of experimentation and results that were probably overcomplicated and way too many words. And it turned out that that was a format that people really liked. I never expected it to happen, but from the very first article, it was super popular. And so I haven't really looked back since then. I still write terrible jokes and way too many words.
That's actually my favorite thing about it, is that it is sciencey, but, like, it's totally crude humor sometimes. Or, I mean, not even that it's, like, crude humor. It's, like, it's just so, it's just so relatable. Yeah, exactly. Like, it's more like punny and silly and kind of, like, self-deprecating. But at the same time, it's like, oh, you're really teaching me stuff too. Like, it would be so, it would be so easy for it to be, like, pretentious, but it's not.
Right. Exactly. So that's basically the reason I do the humor. It's because, I don't know. I find a lot of science writers, maybe not particularly food science writers, but a lot of science writers just take themselves so seriously, and there is this sort of snobbishness in science that I kind of dislike. But, you know, particularly in sort of professional scientists who look down on sort of other types of science, you know, the science that people can do at home every day. And to me, it's like, you know, the point of science should, you know, science should be for everybody to use, and it should be kind of that everybody understands. And so, you know, using pretentious language and looking down on people for not, you know, for example, for trying to do things scientifically, but without getting up to the level of, you know, peer-reviewed published studies, you know, there are different levels of science, and you don't have to look down on one or the other. And at the same time, you know, I think a lot of food writing, I think, really takes itself too seriously, and a lot of, you know, it's just food, you know, at the end of the day, I'm writing a book about food. You know, the most important thing in there is like a better way to make a hamburger, and it's like, you know, it's just a hamburger. It's not curing cancer. It's not saving the world. It hopefully is making a lot of people's lives slightly better. But at the end of the day, like, to take it really seriously, I think would be kind of silly, and also almost insulting to like things that actually are really serious. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like bagels and pizza and hamburgers and those things.
And a lot of nachos.
And they can bring us pleasure, and, you know, and they surely they have like cultural significance and historical significance, but it's still just food. You know, it's just something we eat for pleasure, and at least on this level, you know, obviously we also eat food to survive. But
you're often just telling us how to make our nachos better, which we appreciate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So as far as, I mean, I know the food lab is like a column, and so it's like kind of easy to sort of, you know, like test out recipes every now and then, like as a home cook, but the food lab feels sort of like its own animal. And like for me, home cooking and science, like they sort of feel contradictory. And especially when you're like holding this, you know, tomb that is your book, like how do you make it not intimidating for home cooks to pick up something like this? And, or, you know, what's the marketing strategy as far as like convincing other people that they'll be able to understand food the way that you do?
Well, you know, part of it is so science can be boring, and you know, textbooks can be boring, and so you know, I almost think of it like hiding broccoli in your macaroni and cheese. You know, like it's like you have to wrap the science in a form that is going to excite people and make it easy to digest and make them really want it and make the science stick. And so that's sort of the premise of, you know, the food lab is a book. And, you know, you'll look into it, and every recipe is sort of this classic. Well, mostly in the book, it's American stuff, and on the website, it's not all American. But the book is all these classic American dishes. It's macaroni and cheese, it's meatloaf, it's meatballs, it's steak, it's roast chicken, it's turkey, you know, and it's all these things that people know and are intimately familiar with, and are interested in. And you know, and most of them are things that people have had bad experiences with. You know, like we've all had bad turkey. Mm-hmm. And many people wish on Thanksgiving that their turkey was better. So, If I can say, well, here's a way to make your turkey better. By the way, like, here's the science behind it. You know, getting people interested in the subject first, the better turkey first, is the important part. And then I think the science becomes, showing them that science is the way to get the better turkey is what makes the science exciting. You can't come from the premise that, all right, we're going to teach you a science lesson. By the way, this is going to make your turkey better. Like, going the other way around, I think, is what actually gets people excited.
Yeah. So who are your culinary idols?
Culinary idols. Let's see. I mean, I'm a big fan of Alton Brown.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's pretty sciencey.
You know, I grew up watching Jacques Pepin and reading his books. I would say Jacques Pepin is probably my biggest idol. Not just for his cooking, but for the way he educates people, and like, he's a super generous guy, and is just like a wonderful, wonderful teacher. It's really rare to come across someone who has, you know, great technical chops and knows really well how to cook, but can also sort of pass on that knowledge in a way that isn't intimidating. Because, you know, there are plenty of great chefs out there, but very few great teachers. And, you know, and you'll find that a lot of like cookbooks that chefs put out, they're really more written for themselves than for readers at home. Mm-hmm. or they're more aspirational than instructional. You know, it's like, this is what you could potentially make if you were way, way better and had access.
Yeah, sort of more of like a generosity of spirit.
Yeah, you know, and he always made his stuff really approachable to people.
Yeah.
And, you know, in the same way that Julia Child did, I think she did a great service by taking dishes that people saw as complex and showing people that they're not really that complex. And, you know, I think her spirit, she had that same sort of mentality that, well, it's just food. So it's like, yeah. She messed up all the time. It's like, it's not a big deal if you mess it up. It's just like, it's one meal. People are probably going to enjoy it anyway, and you learn from it, and that's it, you know? So I think, you know, yeah, Jacques and Julia, two people who I think completely changed the way we think about food, and are also just wonderful educators.
Well, I think it's also impossible to, you know, think about what you do and not think about Harold McGee in the same context.
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah.
So, I mean, I know that he's also one of your, like, your heroes or idols. I mean, you wrote it in your book. But I'm curious, like, how you see yourself as distinguishing, you know, your approach and your methods and your style. How is it different than the way Harold McGee has written and the way, you know, food and cooking approaches recipes?
I mean, well, okay, so Harold McGee, I mean, in terms of the science and explaining the science and going really deep into the science, he's untouchable, right? Like, that book, it came out of nowhere, and again, it completely changed the way people consider their food, or at least the way chefs consider their food. You know, my stuff is not so much about the in-depth, rigorous science the way Harold McGee's is. Mine is more about, literally about the science of home cooking. And so, you know, while his experiments might research talks a lot more about, you know, actual drilled down molecular stuff, you know, mine is much more about, well, right, here are like some practical macro concepts that you can really apply in your own kitchen, which one works better. So I think mine, you know, his is more detailed, and his is what a lot of my experiments, what a lot of my writing is based on, but mine doesn't go into the level of details that his does, because my only goal is to help people cook better, whereas his goal is to help people, I think, understand better.
Yeah.
I think they're complementary. You know, you can read McGee's book and get a much deeper understanding of what's going on in your food and what's going on in food science. But it takes a big leap to get from there to how to practically apply it. And so I think that is sort of where I see my role. Like, my job is to take that leap for people and show people how understanding the science can be practically applied to your everyday cooking.
Sure. Like, he leads with science, but you lead with food. Maybe if I were just seriously.
Yeah, maybe that makes sense, I think.
Yeah. If you could cook for anyone, who would you cook for? Sorry to put you on the spot.
For anyone.
Yeah. Like, do you have anyone you've ever envisioned, you know, come into your house and you whipping up some dinner?
I mean, honestly, I think I'd be intimidated to cook for any of my sort of like celebrity idols or things like that. I like cooking for my friends, and I like cooking for my family. I don't know.
I like how much you write about your wife. Like, it really makes your writing so endearing, and like how she puts up with your experiments. I love that part
of
it too.
Put up with a lot.
I was reading about your hamburger experiment, like how you were testing to see if like why McDonald's hamburgers never rot, or you know, how they never go bad.
And like,
I was thinking about your wife because you mentioned like she had to put up with the fact that you had all these different hamburgers like in different stages of molding and rotting, and like
on a shelf above her desk.
Oh,
the only place
I
could find to put them all that where they would all fit. So I removed like all of her photos and like knickknacks and things, and used this entire shelf to hold hamburgers. I should have told her before I did it, but I didn't. And then she came home and found all these hamburgers above her desk one day. But she, you know what? She actually just started working, and it was like, "What's that smell?" And then looked up and saw all the hamburgers. And
it was horrifying. It's like my real nightmare.
For like another month.
Oh, gross. She's very patient. Actually, I have some questions from the ether, like from people who knew you were coming on the show. So if you don't mind.
Sure, yeah.
Okay, cool. So this is from Kelly Fink. She's a pastry chef. And she said, would you ever consider doing something with places that are pushing food education, like, for example, MOFAD, even though you're more of a home cook?
Yeah, you know, I've actually met with the MOFAD folks. This is a while before they opened the museum. Basically, just to talk about, you know, again, I like getting in touch with other food and education-oriented people. Yeah, I mean, I definitely would. I do get involved with other programs, and you know, at culinary school, things like that. Museum of Food and Drink, I would definitely love to do something with them. I'm actually going to be, I think, back on Heritage Radio Network with Dave Arnold on cooking issues in a couple weeks. So maybe we can.
Do you think there's room enough in this tiny studio for both you and Dave Arnold? Like what is going to happen? Like one of your brains is going to explode or something. It's like too much knowledge in one room.
I mean, Dave Arnold is a pretty energetic guy to begin with.
Yeah. I think you guys are quite a pair. Like, I think the room's going to like self combust or like set itself on fire or something. It's just like too much science. but that's cool. And she also wants to know, which restaurants do you feel like are leading the way in the fine dining scene? And to sort of like piggyback on that, like, I was also kind of wondering, like, the scientific approach that you are kind of paving the way or, you know, endorsing mm-hmm. at this point, like, how do you feel like that is affecting like the forward thinking dining scene? And like, how do you see that affecting like the future of restaurants and cooking and restaurants?
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's hard for me to pick a place that's leading the fine dining scene, only because these days I don't eat out that much anymore. You know, back when I lived in New York, I used to do restaurant reviews, and so I would eat out maybe 4 times a week in new places. Now that I live in San Francisco and I don't write restaurant reviews anymore, I kind of took a break from that. So I don't really often eat out that much, so it's hard for me to say things like that. But, you know, I can tell you that I think where fine dining is going, and where restaurants in general is going, I think we're sort of past the point where all these modernist techniques are sort of novel. You know, because there was a time, like, when I was working in restaurants and sous vide was just starting out, and people were just starting to get like liquid nitrogen, and all these sort of modern techniques were trickling down from El Bulli and Alinea and places like that. It was like people were really into it, and it was something that was like completely advertised on menus, and you'd be like, oh, this egg was cooked at whatever 143 degrees, or like this ice cream is made with liquid nitrogen, and that was sort of a thing, you know, because people wanted to experience these new things. These days, like, people don't even bother. Like, now they're just like another tool in your kit, you know, and they're not something that's worth mentioning. So you go to fine dining restaurant these days, and most likely your protein was cooked to vide, or maybe like a CVAP oven. But they don't tell you that. All you know is that it's cooked really well, and cooked, you know, the same way each time, which is really what you should be after at a restaurant. So, you know, I would say as far as fine dining goes, I think it's going sort of the same way that home cooking is going. Home cooking is maybe trailing behind a little bit, but it's moving in the direction of more precision and better understanding, and understanding that, you know, controlling temperature is tantamount to controlling texture and controlling flavor. And I don't think that was necessarily perfectly understood in the past. And so I think a lot of people are just getting a better understanding of you know, sort of the basic thermodynamics of cooking and how heat and temperature are different and how they can be applied to food to get good results, which, you know, it could be used to any number of ends. It could be used to make, you know, fancier food, or it could be used to do sort of those like tricky things where they make one ingredient taste like another or whatever, or appear different. But it could also just be used to make your, you know, like a basic hamburger better, or like the steak at a basic steakhouse better. And I think that's pretty exciting, is that we're just going to get better food all around at sort of every level now that these tools are pretty much commonplace.
Yeah. Do you think we always have to use science when we cook? Like, does it always have to be that thoughtful?
No. I mean, you know, I like to think of science as like a Google map, an online map on your phone or something. And, you know, it's very, and so say you're trying to get from point A to point B, and like when you're cooking that, you know, raw ingredients to finish dish. And say you're trying to get from point A to point B, like you can very easily do it just following the turn-by-turn directions on a map. You know, I can get from home to work following the turn-by-turn directions it gives me, and I'll get there, no problem. And I'll get there consistently. And that's sort of like what, you know, what following your recipe does. And that's totally fine a lot of the time. You can just go on autopilot. You don't have to think much. You just do what it says, and you get to the end result. And that is really what following your recipe or cooking without science is. Cooking with science, I think, is more about, you know, instead of following the turn-by-turn directions, you kind of zoom out on that map and really look at it a little bit, and look at the side streets and look at the general direction of your route. And then you can sort of say, you know what, like, I don't want to follow these parametric directions. I want to take a slightly different route that maybe will add a few minutes of time to my trip, but it's going to give me, like, a view of the ocean. Or maybe I'm going to go out of my way and, like, stop at the pop-up stand to get lunch. Then I'll get to, then I'll get to go to my destination. Or, you know, now that I see what all these roads are going, I can maybe not even go to point B at all, and I can go to point C or point B prime or whatever. And that's, you know, that's what I think Cooking with Science is. It lets you zoom out on a recipe and really understand not just step-by-step how you're getting there, but understand overall where you're coming from and where you're going to, and all the places where you can veer off and go into different territory, or ways you can change the recipe and make it your own. So for me, you know, cooking without science is following turn-by-turn directions, and cooking with science is taking the time to examine the map so you can decide where you want to go.
What about you personally? Do you always apply your kind of scientific strategies when you're cooking, or do you ever just say, like, oh, fuck it?
No, not at all. I mean, last night I got home pretty late and I was hungry, and so I made, so I have a recipe for this tortilla pizza where you basically, like, fry a tortilla in a cast iron skillet and then top it and stick it under a broiler in the skillet, and it gets, like, super crispy and thin. And it's delicious. And, you know, it's something you can make when you're a little bit tipsy at 1 a.m. and as a snack. Well, I make it as a snack before I want to go to bed because I don't want to go to bed on an empty stomach. But no, I didn't use science. I just pulled out a tortilla and did it. And it was, you know, it's a cheesy, kind of cheap, not that thrilling and not that sophisticated snack that required no thinking at all.
Is that kind of a relief sometimes to sort of, like, rest your brain while you're cooking?
It is. You know, I mean, to be honest, most of the time, I use my brain when I'm developing new recipes. If I'm cooking something casually, I almost go on autopilot. And I think maybe this is something that just comes with a lot of cooking experience. You know, like, I've been cooking for a living now for, I don't know how long, 16 years? Yeah, 16 years, I guess, something like that. So I cooked a lot. And so a lot of it is just secondhand. And so if I'm making, there are certain dishes. And I mean, these are many dishes that I don't really think about when I'm making them. I just kind of make them. Or it's not even particular dishes. Like, when you've been cooking a long time, you get to the point where it's just like you open your fridge and you're like, all right, these are the ingredients I have. This is what I'm going to make. It's going to probably take me 20 minutes to do. And you just do it.
And then you're like, science. No.
You know, like maybe the science initially helped me understand these things better, maybe arrive at slightly better techniques or streamline my own techniques or maybe find ways to get more flavor out of a dish. So in that sense, I am using my education, using the science in my background. But it's not something I consciously think about every single time.
Yeah, so. You don't put on the white lab coat every time you, like, cook a grilled cheese.
Right.
Okay, I have another question. This is from Paul Osher. He's a cook at a restaurant in Seattle. He says, all right, this is almost too stupid, but we use Kenji's pie crust recipe for our chicken pot pies. We started cutting small circles in the lid for the steam, but they would often collapse at the rim. So we started cutting a small X in the middle, and now everything is hunky-dory. What gives?
So if I'm understanding this right, you cut a circle and put it over the top of the whatever they're cooking, a ramekin, something like that, and that... If there was no way for steam to vent out, that the edges would end up collapsing. But if there was a way for steam to vent out, then the edges would stay crisp, and not collapse.
We started cutting small circles in the lid for steam, but that didn't work. That made it collapse. So, but then when he applied an X, that seemed to work. They would stop collapsing.
So circles didn't work, but X's did.
Right.
Huh. I honestly have no idea, because both of them, it seems like both of them should serve the same function. I mean, I guess an X would let out a little bit less steam than a circle would, and this is, like, totally just conjecture here, but maybe the circles were letting out too much steam, and so there wasn't enough pressure underneath the crust to keep it sort of up and inflated, but an X traps in some of that steam, and that'll keep the edges inflated, you know, just with just enough pressure to keep it lifted up until it has time to, until the protein has time to solidify and it can stand up under its own support. But that's total conjecture. I honestly have no idea. That's interesting, though.
Do you ever go to Seattle?
I do go to Seattle, yeah. I love Seattle.
Yeah. Well, if you're ever there, go to Pork Chop & Co. and say hi to Paul.
Okay.
And
we'll do. Okay. Yeah. I love Seattle.
Okay, cool. And then you guys can conjecture together in person.
All right,
sounds
cool.
Good.
Kenji, thank you. This was so great to talk to you. You're not going anywhere, but we are going to take a quick commercial break, and then we're going to come back, and we are going to subject you to the dumbest quiz you've ever taken in your life, the morning after quiz.
I doubt it's the dumbest.
It's the dumbest, I promise.
Today's program is brought to you by Cowgirl Creamery, a company located in Point Reyes Station, California, which manufactures artisanal cheeses. In 1997, Sue Conley and Peggy Smith opened Cowgirl Creamery in Port Reyes Station, a picturesque postage stamp of a town on the coast about an hour north of San Francisco. They started with an old barn, made it beautiful, put in a small plant for making handcrafted cheese, bought organic milk from the neighbor, Strauss Family Creamery, and before long, the world found them. Cowgirl Creamery cheeses are sold to over 500 stores, independent cheese shops, farmers markets, and restaurants, and nationally through Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit cowgirlcreamery.com.
And you're listening to The Morning After. I am Sari Kamen, and I've been speaking with Kenji Lopez-Alt. He has dropped some serious knowledge on our little radio station over here, but now, the tables have turned, Kenji. You are about to take the morning after quiz. Now, your name is Kenji, and you know probably all about your name and the origins of that. But what do you know about Benji the dog?
I watched him a little bit when I was a kid.
Okay, so you're a little bit prepared. So I have a quiz for you on Benji the dog. I know, it's so clever. How can you even stand it? It's three questions, multiple choice. Almost no one has ever gotten all three questions right. So, you know, no pressure. Okay, you ready?
Okay,
first question. The first dog to play Benji was a shelter dog named Higgins. After Higgins retired, who took over the role in the subsequent Benji the Dog films? Was it A?
You got to hear the options first.
Easy.
I think I even know this. Okay,
well, you're not allowed to say it before I give you. Okay. You got to play by the rules. Okay, A, was it Higgins' offspring named Benjean? Was it B, a trained actor dog named Mr. Pop Pop? Or was it C, a lady dog named Twinkles who beat out 600 other dogs in an open call audition?
I'm pretty sure it was Benji's kid. I don't know what the dog's name was, but I guess if you say it was Benjean, but I'm pretty sure it was Benji's kid.
You're right. It was actually Higgins' daughter, and her name was Benjean, and she took over for her pop when he retired from the movie business. So well played on that.
and did she go through all of the movies? Because wasn't there one that just came out like way after the other ones? Like
actually, you're right.
Ago?
Why do you know so much about Benji the dog?
I'm good at like club trivia, and I've never seen the new one, but I definitely remember seeing like videos for it or trailers for it it was around the era when I think there was all these remakes, right, and reboots.
Yeah, you're right. As recently as like 2007 or something like that. It's been going on since the 70s. Yeah, so apparently
mid-2000s.
Yeah, it was Higgins, and then his daughter Benjean took over, and then apparently her kid has taken over. I don't know if it was her pop.
Dynasty, huh?
Dynasty, totally. Okay. Next question. Frank he's the man who discovered Higgins at a shelter, and he created the Benji movies and wrote them and, you know, built the whole franchise. When did he discover he had a knack for training animals? Was it A, when he was 7 years old and he rescued a stray dog near his house? Was it B, when he was recovering from a serious car accident at a friend's house and at the same time that friend's family dog had just had a litter of pups? Or was it C, when he went to the zoo as a teen and the animals were constantly drawn to him and it seemed as if he had kind of a sixth sense of communicating with them?
Okay, well, answer C seems like it's not very realistic because I don't think that, well, first of First of all, I don't think there's any such thing as a sixth sense, and zoo animals, I don't think they would get drawn to visitors in that sense, especially if you can't interact with them. So I'm going to eliminate C.
Okay.
So A was when he was a kid, when he was 7 years old, and
yeah.
B was when his friend had a litter of puppies,
yeah, yeah,
from an injury.
Uh-huh.
Okay, between those two, I'm going to go with B just because it sounds like the better story.
Yeah, you're right. You're really good at
right.
this. He had gotten in some sort of serious car accident, and he had he for some reason was at his friend's house recovering from the injury, and a bunch of pups were born right around him, and he realized he was really good at training them, and so that's when it kind of all started.
Nice.
Very, very well done.
Sounds like a good guy.
Right? I know. Okay, so the following is not the name of an actual Benji franchise film or TV series. Okay, not the name. Okay, A, Benji Takes a Dive at Marineland. B, Benji, Zax, and the Alien Prince. C, Benji,
oh,
Benji and the Paranormal Woods of Jillian.
Benji, I'm sorry, say those again? The latter two?
Yeah, B is Benji, Zax, and the Alien Prince. C, Benji and the Paranormal Woods of Jillian. Or maybe it's Gillian. Benji and the Paranormal Woods of Gillian.
Spelled with a G.
Yeah, spelled with a G.
Okay.
And
Benji takes a dive at Marineland.
Benji takes a dive at Marineland.
That sounds like it could be. I'm going to eliminate that. Like, I think that one is a real movie.
Okay.
The other two both sound like they're not. The alien one or the paranormal one?
Right.
All right. I'm going to say that the alien one is a fake movie.
That one is actually real. Benji, Zax, and the Alien Prince is a real thing. And I think it was actually the name of a TV series that started featuring Benji as opposed to a film. But yeah, that really happened. And I just made up Benji and the Paranormal Woods of Jillian or Gillian, which I made up and pretended like I didn't know how to pronounce.
That's
pretty good. I was trying to trick you. Maybe I threw you off.
Yeah, the mispronunciation, I think, threw me.
I think so. I had to do something. You were doing a little too well.
This is called having a biased experiment.
I know. I know. Well, you just know too much about Benji. It didn't feel fair. Well, very well done. 2 out of 3 is certainly very admirable. Very well played.
Do I get like your voice on my voicemail or something like that?
Maybe. Who
like
knows?
A, like, wait, don't tell me.
Wait no. and see. You'll find right. out. Well, Benji, it was Benji. Kenji, thank you. It was absolutely a pleasure talking to you. And I think everyone should go get The Food Lab, the new book. Tell us where you can find it.
You can find it on Amazon.
Okay.
Basically any bookstore. If you go to KenjiLopezAlt.com. That's KenjiLopezAlt, all one word, .com. There's a list of links to places you can buy it from.
Great.
Or if you have a local bookstore, I would recommend going to your local bookstore to get it.
That sounds good. And what about following your column on Serious Eats? How do we do that?
Well, you can find just go to SeriousEats.com, and my column is The Food Lab. It should be pretty easy to find from there. You can also follow me on Twitter or Facebook. Twitter, I'm at The Food Lab. And Instagram, I'm at Kenji Lopez Alt. And Facebook, I'm just The Food Lab on Facebook.
All right. That sounds good. Awesome. Kenji, thank you so much for being on
yeah,
The Morning
thank
After.
You.
It was
well,
a pleasure.
Fine.
Okay, cool. Have a good day. And thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll see you next week.
Listening to the this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.